This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Hello.
A startling story out of Yemen. Another black eye for America. For this, we'll turn straight to Brent.
Yeah, this was shocking, and it was almost missed, I think, by most mainstream papers. It's being picked up a lot today, but it's referring to the fact that the Houthis, an Iranian-backed militant group, terrorist group that's operating inside Yemen, actually stormed the United States embassy this week, taking hostages and also equipment. This is the United States embassy in Sana'a, a capital that the Houthis took over back in late 2014, and actually most American staff was actually transported out at that time. To Saudi Arabia. However, the United States has still occupied the embassy with its staff, local staff, and they all have all their documents are still there, all their equipment is still there. And up to this point, the Houthis have kind of refrained from exercising any type of force on the embassy, but that all changed this week. And this was actually an initial article or initial piece that came out from the Houthis. The rebels themselves reported on it this week. It was translated, the report, by Memory, a group in the Middle East that kind of tracks what the Iranians are doing throughout the world. And then it was reported on by the Washington Free Beacon, and now it's in the Washington Post and everywhere else. But it's just absolutely amazing and surprising that this wasn't discussed by the State Department first, I think, but that it was left to a think tank in the Middle East to discover the story by looking at local reports. Mm-hmm. But here is another American installation in the Middle East that's being taken over by an Islamist terrorist organization, again, with the backing and support of the Iranians. This is not something that takes place without the Iranians giving the go-ahead. And perhaps the reason there's so much silence is because the United States announced, I think last week, that Iran and the United States are going to be sitting down at the nuclear negotiating table here in the next couple of weeks, back to negotiations. There's been a lot of silencing of anti-American actions by the Iranians in the past couple of weeks, silencing by the Americans to try and paint Iran as a changed player. But here again, this is really substantial that there are still actually hostages that the Houthis have by American-employed or United States-employed local Yemenis that are being held hostage right now by the Houthis for ransom and else and other things. So a similar thing to really what you saw happen in Afghanistan, that you've got Americans that are left there. American embassy actually was withdrawn from by the United States, but you had a lot of Americans and had a lot of locals that were working for America that were left there. And now lots of those have been rounded up. And the same thing is happening inside Yemen as well.
It's not difficult to see a direct line of cause and effect from what happened in Afghanistan and the message that the United States sent when it evacuated the country and it left its own people behind at the mercy of local Islamists. But the Biden administration's culpability for what happened here in Yemen is even more direct than that when you look at the fact that Donald Trump had designated the Houthis as a terrorist organization, and really it was very early on in Biden's administration that they removed that designation, which freed up a lot of resources for this group. And now you look at these, you can definitely see this as being direct consequences, can't you?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the last act of the Trump administration, or one of the final acts, I think it was in the last week, is he designated the Houthis as a foreign terrorist organization. He also signed a lot of weapons deals with Saudi Arabia, who are fighting against the Houthis in Yemen and have done for a number of years. But then Biden's first week in office, this was his first foreign policy goal, to try and make out Saudi Arabia to be obviously the bad actor in this war against Iranian-backed Houthis. Biden reversed that designation of the Houthis as a terrorist group. He also announced the United States was ending its support for the Saudi-led war against the Houthis. And then he annulled an arms deal to Saudi Arabia and the UAE. This is in his first week. It's basically saying, no, Houthis, you're okay. You're a legitimate fighter against, you're a legitimate force against the government of Yemen. And we're siding with the Iranian-backed terrorists. We're not going to side with Saudi Arabia anymore. And George Friedman, who writes for Geopolitical Futures, he wrote at the time that Biden's moves may represent a radical shift in U.S. Middle East policy. And he said that the threat of an Iranian-dominated Yemen is real. And that's what we're seeing, to the point now that, you know, the Houthis aren't saying thank you very much for not designated as a terrorist entity. In fact, we just took over your embassy and we're holding people for ransom. We're holding people as hostages. That sounds like a terrorist organization. And so the United States under the Biden administration gave the Houthis a free pass. And what do we see? Anti-American actions. No changes to the state of mind of the Houthis or the Iranians, but the freedom to act and the freedom to not be on the sanction list. And there's no thanks. In fact, they become even bolder in their anti-American actions.
Given what happened in Afghanistan, and as you brought out, the fact that the State Department basically tried to ignore what happened here rather than coming out being forthright and publicizing this information as it happened, gives you a good idea, a strong indication that whoever did this probably took a very safe gamble that they're not going to really face much retaliation from the United States. And it really does once again underscore not only just how weak America has become, but just how hostile to American interests this administration is.
Yeah, I don't have the direct quote with me, but I believe Mr. Gerald Flurry was talking about this and what happened in Afghanistan, and saying that when the United States leaves its own people behind, that the United States is not willing to fight for its own people, then there are going to be a lot of enemies that rise up and take advantage of the situation. It's pretty horrific if you're not going to defend your interest in this way, not just interest, but your own people. And and we're seeing this in Iraq. I remember 2 weeks ago, we're talking about the 10th garrison that was attacked by the Iranians on the border between Syria and Iraq. And that had never happened before, but they know, the Iranians know the Americans are not going to fight back. And now you have another embassy falling to the Iranians. They know, again, the United States is not going to fight back. This is an administration that, by their actions, are actively encouraging Americans abroad, be they military or just civilians, I mean, to become targets. Because the United States, because the enemies of the United States knows the United States is not going to act. And I think in terms of the radical Islamic element, that's, you know, one of the main foreign policy objectives of the Obama administration was to turn Iran into a good guy, to normalize relations with Iran, to actually flip the Middle East on its head and say, well, we've sided with the Saudis and Israel for so long, now we're going to actually level the playing field, which means downgrading ties with the allies, increasing ties with the Iranians. And what do you get? You get an Iranian takeover of the Middle East. This is an American administration backing an Iranian takeover of the Middle East. Something is dreadfully wrong with American foreign policy if this is the case. And evidence bears that out. And Mr. Flurry has written about this. He wrote about this back in 2016-17 in Great Again, one of his booklets. I think there's I forget the chapter in there. I think it might be
The Most Dangerous Lie in History, the chapter 6 of that booklet.
Yeah, chapter 6. If people want to understand this erratic, seemingly erratic,
right,
foreign policy that has design to it, actually, I think they should go back and read that chapter.
Well, thank you very much for that, Brent. Remarkable to see this developing over there. We will keep our eyes on how this unfolds. We have a couple of stories now about friction increasing between Europe and Russia. We'll start by talking about the flood of migrants into Europe from Belarus, something deeply troubling to Europe, but that Russia seems quite happy with. For this story, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, there's a lot of news that's got to be really troubling to Europe that is coming out of Russia. I mean, we've kind of been following this whole story as it's been developing in its various aspects over the last few weeks, even just within the last 24 hours. I mean, here's a headline from The Telegraph this morning: prepare for Russian invasion of Ukraine, US warns European allies. And they report that apparently American officials have been phoning around their European counterparts, saying that they think there's a good chance that Russia could be about to invade Ukraine, just as they did Crimea in 2014. They've got that to pay attention to. Jeremiah talked last time about these natural gas shutoffs, where Putin is really putting the squeeze on the oil pipelines. And then now you've got this situation where Vladimir Putin's puppet, the country of Belarus, a country that everybody knows, they're acting along with Putin's permission, with Putin's help, under their dictator Alexander Lukashenko, and they are flying people in from the Middle East and then pushing them across the borders. They're kind of deliberately creating a migrant crisis on Europe's eastern border, Lithuania and Poland. These were places that didn't have big migrant problems before, that weren't really even prepared to deal with these kind of migrant problems because they're not that close to the Middle East. And now all of a sudden, there are thousands, potentially even tens of thousands, on the borders ready to, or at least 10,000 on the borders ready to cross into these countries.
You spoke about this on the Trumpet Daily yesterday. This is such a sore spot for Europeans, considering all that they've gone through in recent years because of migrants. It's been a real political a terribly divisive issue within Europe, and for Russia to be taking the kind of stance that it is on this, knowing just what a sore spot it is for Europe, is truly provocative.
It is. I mean, the migrant crisis shook the foundations of Europe. This is where you have a lot of these extreme parties started really growing. And this is where a lot of mainstream leaders in Europe started losing their popularity. It led to massive protests. It's an attack on all of Europe, and it's destabilizing for all of Europe. And so for Vladimir Putin to come out and kind of deliberately start doing this, it's hugely provocative. And of course, there's always the unspoken threat of, well, we could make this worse. We're doing maybe 10,000, 15,000. We're working in the thousands right now. We could ramp this up. We could keep doing this for a whole lot longer. That there's plenty of people in the Middle East that want to come over into Europe. Be nice to us.
And also, as you brought out in the Trumpet Daily Show yesterday, this is happening at a time when there is a real dearth of leadership in Europe. And as Gerald Fleury talks about in his cover story from the latest Trumpet print edition, that is a serious crisis within Europe in trying to address issues like the one that it's facing here.
It's just the latest in a whole series, going all the way back to the pullout of Afghanistan and even before, of quite dramatic crises that expose Europe's lack of leadership. And there's plenty of people talking about how weakly Europe are responding to this. I mean, you have to wonder, given the amount of pressure Vladimir Putin is putting on Europe right now, deliberately creating an energy crisis, massing his troops on the borders with Ukraine, and now this migrant push, is he up to something in particular? Are these all part of some big chess move? And is he getting ready to do something? Is this part of a threat? You cross me, I'm going to do something controversial. But if you make a fuss about it, we'll flood you with migrants. We'll cut off your gas. We'll maybe even invade some of your satellites. So it's a lot of pressure on Europe. It really does expose that Russia's got a Putin and they don't. That there is nobody of that kind of caliber. And there's people openly saying that. We have an article by Joshua Michels that's up on the website today talking about this. But he has some quotes from some of these different German language newspapers and things like that, talking about how weak Europe is being and how there is nobody that can go and kind of stand up. And instead it's more like, okay, well, I guess we'll just have to negotiate with Lukashenko. That's the way some of the leaders are talking, whereas the population are kind of crying out for no. They're blackmailing us. We can't just meekly negotiate. We have to take a stand. Mm-hmm. So I think you can see an appetite an appetite for that, but it really does expose Europe's weakness. And this is something that Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry has just really focused in on right from the beginnings of Vladimir Putin really being aggressive. You know, going all the way back to Russia invading Georgia, and he zoomed right in on the effect that it's going to have in Europe. The quote I've got here is from 2014 when Russia invaded Crimea, where he said, "We've been prophesying for around 70 years that Eastern Europe would become a vital part of a new European superpower, a resurrected Holy Roman Empire." He talked about the fear you see in Europe is going to cause 10 leaders to unite in a sudden and dramatic way. Europe's new fear of Russia is going to play a major role in hastening the fulfillment of that prophecy. And right now we see Poland doubling their armed forces. We see a real level of fear in Europe. We see a leadership vacuum. And you could certainly see this tie into all these nations of Europe submitting to one strong leader. And that is one of the key prophecies that Mr. Flurry has drawn attention to right now. And maybe what Vladimir Putin is up to is going to play into that in a really dramatic way. But certainly the Bible prophesies we're getting a strong man soon in Europe. And you see the need for that everywhere you look. It's just a very key Bible prophecy. You can feel right on the brink of being fulfilled.
Well, there's certainly a whole lot there that is prophetically significant, and maybe we'll dig into even more of that as we look at the next item, very related item, focusing on the status of Ukraine being a real point of contention between Europe and Russia. Ukraine wants to join the NATO alliance. Russia is deeply opposed. To learn about this, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, there was a really salient analysis this week by Konstantin Atlamazoglou. He works on transatlantic and European security. And in this analysis, he just kind of zoomed out a bit, looking at this whole situation, just to try to look at the big picture, even with Russia's point of view factored in. So he talked about the way U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin has recently visited Ukraine, and how Austin talked a great deal on that trip about Ukraine joining NATO, or the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. And Atlamazoglou talked about just how provocative those kinds of meetings and moves are to Russia. He wrote, quote, "Ukraine borders Russia and provides Russia with a wide buffer zone to its west. Ukraine joining NATO could mean U.S. troops and missile installations right on Russia's border. Preventing that is a vital Russian interest." End quote. And then a little further down, Mr. Atlamazoglou says, "It would also be bad for NATO." He writes, "Should Ukraine join NATO, a Russian attack against it would trigger the alliance's Article 5. Failure to invoke Article 5 in such an event would be NATO's end. But even if NATO were to invoke Article 5, the alliance's record is mixed and never tested against a superpower." End quote. And he also argues that these kinds of statements from the Biden administration are the reason why Russia is amassing those troops near Ukraine once again. It's a red line for Russia, and Russia is demonstrating that it is willing to go to war to prevent the loss of that buffer. He also argues very compellingly, I think, that if Russia does attack, they would do so before Ukraine is all the way through the NATO membership process. And so that would leave Ukraine uncovered by NATO's umbrella and just be terrible for the Ukrainian people. He writes, quote, "Secretary Austin is correct. Ukraine does have a right to decide its own future foreign policy, but to pretend that it can do so in a geostrategic vacuum is foolish and will only lead to suffering." You know, and like Richard said a moment ago, more and more U.S. leaders are also talking about this Russian buildup. They're taking it very seriously, and they're saying that this time, actually be the start of an invasion. So it's really raising a lot of red flags and just could escalate quite quickly.
What is interesting to lay out the case, as you did, for why Russia would be so concerned about the status of Ukraine, as there's obviously quite a lot of reasons on the European side why they also believe that Ukraine has every right to join NATO. And there are quite a few European leaders who've stepped up and said that they should. Even U.S. leaders have said that Ukraine should be able to determine its own future. And so there is a certain amount of pushback against what Russia is doing here. But you put all of this together and the pressure that Russia is putting on Europe, it's quite extraordinary, especially given what we understand about Bible prophecy. Richard was focusing on just how much this could increase the demand for strong leadership within Europe, and that is certainly the case. But this fear that Russia is instilling within Europe, this is a trend that we have focused on for years now.
Yes, it is. Yeah, and it's something that Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry has written about a number of times over the years. As Richard mentioned, he wrote about it just after the Georgia invasion, just after the Crimea invasion. And I think that's it's easy to see how that's going to be one of the major catalysts that leads to European unification politically and militarily.
Where would you send people for more information just to understand the prophetic ramifications of what's happening here?
Well, Richard mentioned the 2014 article that Mr. Flurry wrote. It's called The Crimean Crisis is Reshaping Europe. That's a powerful one. And then Mr. Flurry also wrote kind of a milestone article in 2008, just after Russia had invaded Georgia, which really gives a lot of the Russian perspective and shows why the Russians feel compelled to do this, especially when they feel kind of betrayed by U.S. leadership in the way NATO has expanded into their space. That one's called Russia's Attack Signals Dangerous New Era.
I guess the one other aspect of this, and we've talked about this kind of intermittently over the years, is that Ukraine is sort of the dividing line between Europe and Russia, and exactly where that line falls when you talk about the dividing between what we term the King of the North, or what the Bible terms King of the North, and the Kings of the East, that Ukraine is in this, it's this battleground area that could very well be split. The contention over this country really could be, where we see exactly where Europe ends and the Kings of the East begin.
Yeah, that's a great point. It's hard to know if Ukraine would end up breaking off and joining with the King of the North, the Europeans there, or if they would go entirely with the Russian side, or as you said, maybe it'll split tidally along some of the kind of geopolitical lines that are already there, and half of it go one way and half the other.
Well, we do appreciate you bringing that to us, Jeremiah. We'll keep our eyes on what's happening over there. At the Climate Change Summit in Glasgow, some sources say one of the most popular attendees was former U.S. President Barack Obama. He brought a message that further exposes just how radical this man's thinking is. For this story, we'll go to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, the Climate Change Summit is winding down now, just about over. But this week, they finally had former U.S. President Barack Obama give his address. And there's been a number of analysts just really commenting on just kind of how unusual to have like this much publicity and an acclaim over an address by a former U.S. president. He's not one of the current heads of state, officially, at this conference, so you'd think he'd probably be one of the more minor figures, even though his speech was really kind of the keynote moment of the second week of the conference, and you can really see why that is. He spent a good bit of time attacking U.S. President Donald Trump for his decision to pull out of the Paris Climate Change Agreement, and that got him quite a bit of traction because he was the one who unilaterally signed America up to some very drastic carbon reduction targets under this Paris Climate Change Agreement. And then President Donald Trump came in after him and pulled him out. And then now President Biden's come in and put them back in. So you've kind of got this game of ping pong between the Democrats and the Republicans over we're going into this agreement. But Barack Obama has definitely gone on record this week as saying that he was really upset when President Trump took the United States out of that agreement. He's glad they're back in. And then he spent the rest of his address really just talking to the young people. That's kind of where he's his hope to make sure that America doesn't pull out again. Telling the young people that we want you to stay angry, I want you to stay frustrated, but harness that anger. And the that part of the address was really sobering, because it's really speaking more of the language of like a political revolutionary, talking about just needing to like harness the, your anger and frustration of the youth for revolutionary change, and harnessing people's anger as an effective tool as a political revolutionist. It's far less useful in science or climate policy debates. Mm-hmm. Normally when you're talking about something about like, well, how do we emit less carbon, that's something that takes some sound, rational, level-headed thinking, not trying to get young people around the world, most of whom haven't studied the issue, whipped up into a revolutionary fervor.
Brad McDonald, the Trumpet.com managing editor, wrote about this in his Trumpet brief yesterday and just talked about how this is very consistent with the kind of anti-American agenda that that Barack Obama has promoted throughout his time in power, and how it's also being pushed through the Biden administration, over which Obama bears quite a lot of influence.
Right, because actually while he's giving this speech back in America, you've got President Biden's new nominee for comptroller of the currency, Soleil Omarova, who's literally a communist from Kazakhstan, who's gone on record saying that the Soviet Union did better in terms of their what they paid their people than what America does, and that the Soviet system was better, and that we need to like abolish banks here and just have a central bank run digital currency, and some radical ideas. But she spoke this week about establishing like a national investment authority to fund green energy projects, and then kind of let the cat out of the bag that she said she's hoping that America's oil, gas, and coal industries just go bankrupt, and that's how you get rid of them. And so Biden, with these new methane and carbon reduction targets he's setting over there in Glasgow, he's really doing all he can to make sure that Omarova's hopes come to pass, and these industries actually do go bankrupt. Which would leave, which would really help out, which would really help Vladimir Putin and what Jeremiah was talking about just a minute ago. If these Eastern European countries are looking for where to get gas and energy, and Putin's kind of deliberately stirring up an energy crisis over there, and at the same time, Biden and Obama are really helping him out with that energy crisis by doing everything they can to bankrupt American energy companies. And start building windmills, which have and solar panels, which have their place, but also have a proven record of not being very efficient at generating massive amount of energy in a short time.
Yeah, yeah, it's really remarkable how much buy-in there is to this extremely radical agenda that is remarkably destructive and detrimental to the health and the prosperity of civilized nations, and it just comes across as such a noble cause. But like Mr. McDonald talked about in his Trumpet brief, the language that he's using, and as you brought out, just encouraging young people to be angry and to stay frustrated and to get out there and just do whatever you can to keep pushing this agenda. It shows this is not a logic. It's not a science driven movement. This is just purely kind of a revolutionary rhetoric that is aimed at fundamental transformation of the most successful nation in history. And we've got quite a bit of literature that exposes what is really going on here. I'd encourage you to read Mr. McDonald's article, just talking. He underscores that spiritual dimension to the kind of language coming from Barack Obama. We also will put a link in the show notes to an older article that Gerald Fleury wrote, what the Paris Climate Agreement was really about. And it is important to see the nakedly anti-American nature of this agenda as it's being promoted. Thank you very much for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, Europe proposing another step toward a unified European military, and China's president paving the way to become emperor for life. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
We spoke in the first half about how Europe knows it must respond robustly to threats from Russia and other significant threats rising in the world today. It's trying to overcome the seemingly insurmountable obstacle of building a military among 27 nations, a military that can take real action. To learn about the latest steps that it is taking and the proposals that are being made, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, we had a pretty significant news come out on this this week, where the European foreign minister, Joseph Borrell, he's traveling around with some new proposals that would see a new groups of 5,000 soldiers, a European rapid reaction force set up, and also an EU rapid hybrid response team that would be able to move quickly. Now, those ideas aren't really new. Europe has had on paper rapid response forces before. Where this is very significant is that he and others within Europe are talking about making these responses, these groups able to move without the agreement of all 27 member states. So not having to wait and get these 27 round to sit on the agreement. I mean, this is why Europe has paper armies that have never been used, or rapid response forces, because it's not a rapid response force if you've got a committee of 27 nations has to sign off on it. So this is an initiative that it actually began a while ago. I think it was last year or maybe even 2019. Germany has been one of the nations doing the most to push it. But there's certainly a lot more urgency that has come along since the what happened in Afghanistan, where Europe had a situation where they needed to act quickly and couldn't. And that's really given it some dramatic urgency. So this has been laid out before European leaders just over the week or so. And then the plan is to kind of have it formally agreed 2022, have practice maneuvers 2023, kind of come into full force 2025. But it's that ability to deploy without signing off on everybody that does make this something more significant than probably we've seen from Europe on this front for a while.
I think anytime we talk about these kinds of initiatives from Europe, where they're trying to get their military to where it's able to take action and so on, there are details that would make it to where a lot of people would look at it and say this is not really that big of a deal. 5,000 troops, and not necessarily a huge force, and rolling this out over a period of years. But it's like every single one of these steps that are being taken, it really is a wedge to get the door open where you could see it could be dramatically expanded. And the reason why we look at this as such an important development is exactly what the Bible says is going to happen and what we should expect to see happening from Europe. Military might is just a hallmark of this rising European empire.
Absolutely. I mean, just going back to what you said at the start of that, this is, you know, in some ways, this is a Rubicon. This is a big deal to cross that line where now you don't have 27 nations have to sign off on this. Now we're getting into some fairly significant changes into the way EU governance works, and you're having that step where countries are handing over responsibility for their armed forces to another European country. And that is huge. And that is one of the things that has always, always stood in the way of Europe moving forwards effectively on here. And I think an interesting side point to this is that at the moment, not all 27 nations are on board with this. Hmm. There are some that are kind of aghast at this idea of letting another nation have the say-so as to when their military is deployed. And they're dead against moving to unanimity. And you know, the, like you said, there's incredibly specific prophecies in the Bible about it being a military power, and it talks about it being a 10-nation power as well, not 27 nations. Mm-hmm. So you could see this kind of thing playing a major role potentially in shrinking the European Union down, and there's talk of this in the proposal as well. A smaller group that are willing to give up that kind of control over their armed forces moving forwards while the rest stay behind, and that could be a real dividing line between those that go on to become this tight-knit superstate and maybe others that sit in an outer ring. So this, I think, does have the potential to succeed and to be significant, whereas other efforts have just been bits of paper. So I think really interesting to watch. There are, like you said, just the Bible talks about Europe being a war-making machine. You read those prophecies in Revelation chapter 13, Revelation chapter 17, and this story does tie into everything we were talking about in the first half about Europe's need for a strong leader. I think one of the points Mr. Flurry hit really hard in his latest Trumpet Print article is that if you are going to have a strong army, you need a strong leader to lead that army, and you're not going to be able to have a strong army while you're led by a committee, even if it is a smaller committee. So this is a significant step. It's a step that will probably only take Europe so far. It's not going to solve all their military problems while they don't have a strong leader, but this is... this is a step towards that prophecy that Herbert W. Armstrong was saying for years, that you will see Europe start off as an economic union, then it will become a political union, finally it will become a military union. And we've seen that exact process in that exact order. And he was making that forecast based on what the Bible says about this European power. So you can read some of those quotes and some of what the Bible says in our Trends article, Why the Trumpet Watches Europe's Push Towards a Military. And then Mr. Gerald Flurry's article, Europe is About to be Hijacked, from the latest Trumpet print edition, is a great place to see what is next for Europe.
Thank you very much for that, Europe. One quote from the article that was in the Daily Mail about this that I just chuckled over. It was quoting Mr. Borrell, the EU foreign policy chief. And it says he was not asking to abolish the unanimity rule, but he added, what I believe is that this institutional setting can be flexibilized in order to act quicker and better, which is just a remarkable euphemism for casting aside the rules and doing what they want to do. I'll have to remember that, flexibilized. Well, that's the way that we can approach the laws. But that really is part and parcel with the way that the EU operates. And you do expect a lot more of that kind of behavior in the time ahead in fulfillment of those prophecies. Moving on, China's president is flexibilizing the laws over in China, successfully taking steps to secure his power indefinitely. To learn about this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, on Thursday, the elites in China's Communist Party, about 400 party leaders, approved a new resolution written by President Xi Jinping about, well, it's just about the history of the Communist Party. And this marks the first time that such a doctrine has been delivered by a Chinese leader in 40 years. So just a major milestone there. And as you said, this is seen as a key step in clearing the way for Xi Jinping to rule China for as long as he lives. So this happened at the end of the CCP's annual closed-door meeting, the four-day plenum that lasted from Monday to Thursday. And the full text of Xi's resolution hasn't yet been made public, but we know that it is essentially a summary of the Communist Party's 100 years of history. And we know that just the fact that Xi was able to push this through is a huge step. This is something that only two previous Chinese leaders have ever done before. They were Mao Zedong, the founder of the People's Republic of China, and Deng Xiaoping, who made China an economic superpower. So these are the two most potent rulers in China's 70-year history. They both authored a historical resolution to the official CCP narrative, and then they both went on to dominate Chinese politics until they died. And now Xi Jinping is joining their ranks. Bloomberg wrote about, well, just the momentousness of this yesterday and said, quote, getting the group of 400 mostly male party elites, including state leaders, military chiefs, provincial bosses, and top academics to endorse his vision sends a strong signal that Xi has the power base to clinch a precedent-defying third term. end quote. So that's really the significance of this. We've seen signs for a couple of years now that Xi Jinping is planning to, you know, flexibilize the traditional two-term limit in China. If he were to abide by that law, he would be stepping down next year. But there have been indications since late 2017 that he was planning something different. And now we see this latest sign that makes it all the more clear. Xi is rewriting history and cementing his status in that history. And the upper echelons of the party are giving him their full approval to do it all. So it's all just setting Xi up to become essentially an emperor of China who can rule with almost no checks on his power and apparently for as long as he would like to.
He really has been quite a transformative leader for China, hasn't he? I mean, you look at what his nation has accomplished under his rule, how much it has risen in prominence within the world. And, you know, it's kind of like the future is wide open. I don't think there were too many people before he took office talking about China being sort of the owning the future the way that they are now. Maybe you could talk a little bit about his legacy even to this point in his rule, and then what this means for China and how this revision would affect China's future.
Sure, yeah. Yes, it has been utterly transformative, everything that we've seen under Xi Jinping. Just quite a lot of focus on not just military, but on reducing China's traditional focus on land power, on the army, and shifting all of that toward more of a naval focus. You know, and so he's of course used that to stake all kinds of claims in the South China Sea. He's even built the islands there that we talk about so often. He covets his neighbors' territories and their resources, and he's shown himself willing to use force to try to get all of that. So all of that has just upended the whole power balance in Asia, and it's even started to change a lot of just the global power dynamic there. And with this new revision, basically, he's changing the way the story of the Communist Party is told. And as I said, we don't know all the details about what will be included, but the revision is going to give the quote-unquote correct interpretation of history, you know. And by extension, it'll give all of China the so-called correct view. And we don't know exactly, as I said, how he's going to twist the narrative or distort the facts, but it is expected to be a bombshell, and it's causing all kinds of buzz among analysts around the world. G-Zero Media wrote a bit about this week, and they said, quote, "Xi's revision won't just be an anodyne internal document that only CCP nerds will obsess over. Xi's historical revision will influence everything in China, from foreign policy to what's taught in schools or shown on TV and in films, to what constitutes the ultimate crime of disloyalty to the party. It will influence all of that for an entire generation, if not longer." So, you know, Xi Jinping is really taking a page out of 1984 here. Who controls the past controls the future. Who controls the present controls the past. You know, he's tinkering with China's past in order to pilot its future. And we can expect that however it's written, America and its allies will look much worse, and China will look like the savior of the world, and this will just infuse all of the Chinese people with a lot more dangerous jingoism and nationalism. And of course, Xi Jinping is also casting himself as the successor to those heavyweights, Mao and Deng Xiaoping. So this is really a major step in just cementing his status as a strongman.
And how do you view this prophetically? Why is it significant according to the Bible's prophecies?
Yeah, well, in the Trumpet's January 2018 issue, Mr. Stephen Fleury wrote an article that just focuses on kind of a global return to strongman rule, which is happening in China and in so many other nations around the world. And in one part of that, he writes, quote, "It is one of the most stunning reversals in history. For nearly two centuries, the dominant geopolitical trend in the world was the spread of democratic free societies. The British Empire led the way in the 19th century, the United States did it during the 20th century, but this century will be totally different. The dominant trend thus far has been the rise of authoritarian strongmen. We are falling back into a dark age." So Mr. Fleury really frames that all in the context of the times of the Gentiles prophecy and it, just how this indicates that that's what we're headed back into. And then in that same issue of the Trumpet, we include an article specifically about Xi Jinping, just pointing out that he's rapidly becoming one of the most powerful and ruthless men on earth, and just how alarming that development is.
All right, very good. We thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. We also will link to an article that we have on the website, Xi Jinping, Emperor for Life. You can find that on the show notes for today's program. We thank you. And evidence of Iran's efforts to extend its malign presence into North Africa emerged this week. For this story, we'll go back to Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, there's a report that came out in Reuters this week, which is kind of just coming out before a fully fledged report that's meant to come out on Wednesday. But this is kind of like a preview that has said that there is lots of evidence that guns supplied by Iran from its Houthis rebels are actually making their way from Yemen across the Gulf of Aden into Somalia, and finding their way into the Horn of Africa region. Now, this is something that is pretty important because it's what we've watched for. We even talked about this last week, how we expected, and we expect based on biblical prophecy, that Iran is going to really try and take advantage of the destabilization there to try and control the situation. And we even talked about last week how there were drones, Iranian-made drones, that were spotted as part of the Ethiopian army in the past couple of weeks. And now we have proof and evidence of illicit arms transfers that are making their way to the Horn of Africa that come from Iran. This is what the report to be published on Wednesday says: weapons originating in the Iran-Yemen arms trade are being trafficked onward towards Somalia itself. And then the Reuters report says that we're not fully able to determine, or they are not fully able to determine, who the buyers and the sellers of these weapons are. They know they're Iranian made. However, they said that a number of these weapons have included serial numbers that are very close together, indicating that it's not a third party that's just grabbed a bunch of Iranian-made weapons, but that they were actually part of an official production line of the Iranians that made its way to Yemen and then was transferred directly, without being dispersed in Yemen first, directly then to Somalia. And of course, we know that Iran has a lot of terrorist contacts in Somalia, al-Shabaab being the main one. However, as the ethnic war increases inside Ethiopia as well, it's likely that Iran is going to try and maximize its partners, not just settling for al-Shabaab, but also to others in that region.
Help us understand the larger strategic aims that Iran would have in supplying these weapons.
Well, Iran is always looking for ways to maximize its influence outside of its territory. And it knows and understands that the critical parts of foreign policy power right now involves world trade. And if Iran, a small country, relatively speaking, or a less powerful country, relatively speaking, to European nations, Russia, China, United States, if it's going to exert force, it needs to control trade routes. And so a very important area for it to control is the Red Sea Passageway, the eastern seaboard of that being Yemen, but then also the western seaboard. It's obviously never going to control Saudi Arabian territory. And so it's important for it to control the Horn of Africa region, Eritrea, perhaps even Djibouti, and maximize its partners there. Iran is not going to, or at least its modus operandi up to this point, has not been to flood other territories with Iranian soldiers. No, it first creates allies. Mostly it will create allies with Shiites, Shiite Muslims. However, it does use Sunni Muslims to fight for it with its cause, and really does do very well at maximizing loose affiliations to the Iranian state for its own purpose. We saw that when it supported the Taliban over the past 5 or 6 years, supporting them with finances, supporting them with weaponry, and even instructing them how to get rid of the United States, so in the end, Iran state could benefit from it. So we see that Iran is making a play and picking sides in the war for the Horn of Africa. And that is important biblically, because according to biblical prophecy, because we know that Iran is going to try and maintain power in these areas. I think a good article for people to read about the end time prophecies relating to Iran's push here is Iran Gets a Stranglehold on the Middle East, a 2015 article by Mr. Gerald Flory.
Thank you for that, Brent. U.S. President Joe Biden has just passed a massively expensive infrastructure bill, but somehow he says this is going to drive down inflation and save Americans money. To help us try to detect the logic, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, it's interesting that that Jeremiah just mentioned 1984, because that's what this story reminded me of, the whole like war is peace, freedom is slavery, starvation is plenty type movement, because you've got inflation keeps breaking records. I saw a headline that said your money is now losing close to 1% of its value every 30 days.
Right, yeah, the consumer price index was 0.9%.
Right. So almost like 0.9%. So it's like every month your dollars like about almost 1% were less than it used to. And the government, they normally say they target 2% inflation a year, not 1% a month. But Biden, he's got this huge $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill that he's just passed, and he's actually touting it as a way to reduce inflation. He had a tweet on Sunday that said the bipartisan infrastructure bill will help ease inflationary pressures, lowering cost for working families. And so it just kind of takes you back for a minute, because it's like you just think about it. It's like, okay, well, inflation's caused when you dilute the money supply by printing money. Now we don't have $1.2 trillion, where we're already projected to be $2 trillion. A $2 trillion deficit this year. So none of this money is money we've collected through taxation or earned or generated. It's all money that's either going to have to be borrowed or printed. The money that's printed will contribute to inflation right away. The money that's borrowed will end up contributing to inflation eventually, because as you increase the debt, it makes it more likely that you're going to have to print money to pay for stuff later. And so you'd think that This is pretty basic arithmetic, that this bill is going to increase inflation. And I guess I did find that that Biden went in, and the way he's trying to sell this, as he said that, well, the bill is going to modernize our ports and our airports, and that's going to clear out blockages in the supply chain that's causing price increases. And you're like, all right, well, I looked at the bill, and about 10% of it is for that. The rest is either straight up pork or going towards things like government run internet. And even that 10%, it's like the supply chain shortages, I've looked pretty deeply into those, are not caused by old ports. The old port was working fine a year ago. It's caused by labor shortages. So maybe the people at the port would like it to be modernized, but sending $1 trillion to do it is going to increase inflation the old-fashioned way by diluting the money supply, and is not going to clear out the supply chain shortages unless you actually get more workers at the port, because it can be as nice a port as you want if there's no one working there.
Isn't it remarkable how it seems this man is just willing to say whatever he feels like saying? I mean, there's just so much deceit in the words that come out of his mouth, and you would think there would be more people that would be just truly troubled.
Right.
That deceit is just such a regular currency in American politics.
Yeah, there was a time when, a big spending, big government left-wing politician like this would come out and be like, hey, I know this big infrastructure bill is going to increase inflation a little bit, but it's worth the sacrifice for the ports and the government-run internet and all the stuff I want to give you. Now, it's like Jack's Magic Bean or something like that. It's like, they're like, I'm going to get this new bill. It's like snake oil salesman. It's like, I've got this like new bill that's going to like modernize the ports, modernize the infrastructure, give everyone free internet, and reduce inflation at the same time.
Right. Yeah, it is. It's the old-fashioned snake oil salesman. Actually, the headline that that you sent me, you wrote this headline, right? The Ministry of Plenty.
Yes.
Boasts new $1.2 trillion infrastructure deal will help drive down inflation. Yeah, that really is. It really is right out of 1984, isn't it? So where would you send people for a better understanding of where this is taking the country and why it's important prophetically?
Yeah, the one article we can put in the show notes is actually a chapter from our He Was Right booklet entitled Our Financial 9/11 Was Prophesied, which isn't going to delve into, I don't know, just like this spirit of lies that we've talked about a little bit for the past couple minutes, but it will talk into like the Bible prophecies that talk about an economic collapse coming to America and things like these huge $1.2 trillion infrastructure bills, which are creating inflation and creating debt and not helping the supply chain shortages, which many Democrats deliberately want to reduce consumption and reduce greenhouse gases and things like that. It is really just pushing America to economic disaster, like that chapter we'll put in the show notes explains.
All right. Thank you very much for that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. And thanks to Parker Campbell for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of C.S. Lewis. The older education was a kind of propagation. Men transmitted manhood to men. The new is merely propaganda. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG. And online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.